Good morning, and happy Resurrection Day. It's amazing how songs bring it back. That the first one we sang was, we sung that at my baptism, and I think I was 6 years old, and I could still remember like looking out into the crowd, and just, it was at Westwoods, there was a ton of people. And singing that song, and then Our God Reigns, we did that, and we were in Canada around a campfire, and they would sing that over and over, and then if someone couldn't pick a song, that one would break out, or God is an Awesome God, and there's just something about singing around a campfire that's, it's fun. We're going to start in Mark. Mark 16. I always thought of Easter as the Super Bowl of Christianity. And We have two big holidays, is when he was born and when he died, right? When Jesus came and when he died. And he is the only living God. If you go through all of history and you Google like what's a living God, and every God that has like said that they were God at some point, Jesus is the only one that is alive still. And you could check, there was a Buddha and Allah, and there's tons of them. Jesus is the only one that's still alive. And there's always something real about that name. Even people that are, I've talked to several atheists and people that don't believe, and yet those people will still use the Lord's name in vain and things like that. They won't say, oh, Allah, or things like that. There's power in the name Jesus. So, that being said, let's just read a little bit in Mark 16 about the resurrection. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb, and they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large, and entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. And he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. So let's just open up in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you and praise you for who you are and this time that we could have to talk about you and worship you and learn more about you. And please, Lord, let your words be spoken and not mine. And we just thank you for being the one true living God. In the name of Christ we pray. So that was kind of like reading the ends at the beginning. But how did we get to this point with Jesus being dead? And raising again. And he predicted these things, and we'll hopefully cover that. When we think about even when he came, when he first came to this city, right? Last Sunday was considered Palm Sunday, right? That's what some people call it. And Jesus came into this town And he said to go get a donkey, right? The donkey was never ridden. And I don't know if anyone's tried to ride a horse. I personally don't care for horses that much. When I was a young guy, I always thought my Uncle Bruce is like a man's man. He was a tree guy, real strong. And he had one of his friends come over. My Aunt Wendy, who was his wife, she had a horse, and they would get their horses together, and this guy would, like, shoe them. And so here I am thinking, as I was a little kid, thinking, like, these are, like, big, strong men. And I watched the horse kick my Uncle Bruce's friend, and he was down for a while. And that I thought that guy was, like, the strongest guy on earth. And then the horse kind of just kicked him, and he was done. And ever since then, I was good with horses. I didn't really... I touched their nose a little bit, and I was good with that. But they would always say, well, don't walk behind the horse. And I was like, yeah, no kidding. And then, so anytime I had to walk around the horse, I'd go, like, way around the horse. But anyway, so Jesus took this donkey, and he rode it in. The donkey had never been ridden before. Like, donkeys are stubborn as it is, and to train them to be ridden it takes a while. There's things you got to do, and it's, you need patience, and you got to do this stuff. And he just rode it. He's like, just bring me one that has never been ridden. That's the one I want. And they're like, what are you going to do with this? They brought it to him. There he goes. He rides it into the city. And they were putting, when he was walking in, they were putting palms down and things like that. Hence, Palm Sunday. Then he had to go to Herod and meet with these people, and some people wanted him crucified, some people didn't. And crucifixion was designed to cause the most amount of pain for the longest amount of time without the person dying. When someone gets crucified, they die from suffocation, and it is a brutal death. But getting to that point, there was still many other things that happened to him. There was all this pain that happened to him. They whipped him, and they were plucking him. And it constantly says, as you're reading through, like, his death time, like the time that he died and stuff, how people mocked him. And you know, they say the phrase, you know, sticks and stones break my name, but names never hurt me. And anytime you're mocked or gossiped about or anything like that, it still hurts. And, like, you can try to hide it. I know, being a guy, like, we try to hide all our feelings. So according to my kids, no one calling me a name has ever hurt me. But it stings. It hurts. And you could, when you're quiet and with your thoughts, sometimes that could get on you. Before he did all that, he spent time with God. He went to the mountain and prayed. And it was so intense for him that it says that he had blood like sweat, or he sweated blood. And then during that time, he had just a few of his closest friends with him. And he asked him to just stay awake with me. He didn't even really ask him to do anything. Just stay awake with me. And they didn't even do that with him. So here Jesus is on earth. And then knowing that this crucifixion and all this physical pain is coming. If you ever had to wait for a surgery or something like that, and you knew there was going to be pain involved, it's a tough... You just want to get it over with. And there he is on the mountain praying before this, and his closest friends couldn't even stay awake with him. So I can only imagine at this point that Jesus, as a man, just felt very alone. And he was just by himself, and he was in that... when you're alone and you feel you're by yourself, you could get in your own thoughts and start to just go down this rabbit hole of weird thoughts. When I was in Sunday school and stuff like that, they tell you that even a thought, you can sin, right? And how do you control those thoughts? How is it that, you know, if that person cuts you off in traffic, or even if you're in a line? I remember I stood in a lot of lines on vacation this week, and every now and then we'd be standing in line, and, you know, like they would have, you know, two registers, and there would be one line formed, and then a person would just come out of nowhere and just walk in front of you. And it happened to me a couple of times, and it took a lot for me to hold my tongue. I wanted to say something, but we were on vacation. We had nowhere to go. And us being from the north, that we like everything fast and fast. It's fast. My wife has to remind me constantly that we're in the south. They're a lot slower than us. Just remember that. Like a Dunkin' Donuts trip up here, if it takes more than 5 minutes, we're upset, right? Down there, it was 10 minutes every time. But how do I control my thoughts of that person cutting in front of me? And that was just, well, maybe they were in a rush to go sit by the pool or so. I don't know. But they had to cut me. But how do you control your thoughts? And if anyone has a real answer for that, let me know after. But as far as I can see, if you read Psalm 37:4, it says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. If you delight yourself in the Lord, and Joshua, I think it's 1:9 or 8, it talks about praying day and night. And if your mind is constantly on the Lord and things of God, you'll be all right. Your thoughts will go in a different place. And then one of my favorite verses, Romans 12:9, the beginning of it says, let love be genuine. If you truly love people and God's people and creation and things like that, your thoughts will be different. As they could. So with Jesus, I'm gonna find my spot again. So in the Gospels, all four Gospels talk about his resurrection. And if you, coming up to this, you know, I was reading each one, and each one has similarities. Each one has their own thoughts on it, and they all see it from a different angle. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They all kind of see it a little bit different. And I think when the Lord was talking and setting up the Bible for us, He is obviously all-knowing and smarter than us, and he has his plan. And I just think it was just a great example of how, you know, even us nowadays, we could all take a verse, and if we all had to preach or talk about the verse, we'd all probably come at it from a different angle because we've all had different lives and different experiences. We wouldn't listen to anything Marty said, but we would, but we would all have that different thing. You know, Marty jokes around, but he says, you know, learn from my mistakes or don't do what I'm saying and stuff like that. And it's just a different way. And I love the way that there's just four different versions. This story and all this stuff around Jesus' life is so important that he talked about it four times. And it's a really big part. And then that's kind of why I think it's, you know, the Super Bowl. Even the Pope today has double pneumonia, and he has to be carted around, but he's going to service today. Not that that means much, but I just thought that was an interesting that the news even had to talk about that. So we have in Matthew the same it's chapter 28. I'm just going to read a little bit here. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes white as snow. And for fear of him, and guards trembled and became like dead men. And the what's interesting about that is who guards a tomb? You know, like they might not have believed, but they believed enough to put guards at the tomb. Because as we know through Jesus' life, he had many miracles. And to be so afraid of something like that, to guard it when it's dead, I find that very interesting and powerful. And they put this in the, multiple times it talks about the stone being large. And then they sealed it. Back then they would seal things with wax and whatever, and then they would put their, some of those guys had rings and they would poke it if they had like a scroll or something. And have you ever tried to move a stone? They're heavy. I have the pleasure of working at a golf course right now, and one of the jobs we had to do was to move a stone. And you know, a stone the size of this little podium thing could be too heavy for us to pick up. We would need a machine to pick it up. And then they also have, you know, this same size stone could weigh anywhere from 100 pounds, but it could also weigh 800 pounds, depending what's in the stone. So I just wonder what kind of, like, how big was this stone? And it had to be big enough to be able to fit a person inside of it, right? So this is a big stone guarded by two people. And so now that the guards become, so verse 4, the fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. So these guys are asleep now. But the angel said to the women, do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. And a bunch of times he talks about the temple, and we'll hopefully get into that too, but he talks about the temple and it raising in 3 days. And come see the place where he lay. So they go quickly and tell his disciple that he has risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you. So I, you know, thinking about if we have ever buried a loved one and gone to the gravesite, and we typically don't stay there for the whole thing, right? We go there and we, you know, we'll see the hole and then workers kind of do all that part of it. But back then, they were most likely highly involved in putting the body in the tomb. They might have helped wrap them and all this other stuff. But I would imagine back then, it wasn't just workers taking care of everything. It's going to be a lot of family-oriented, and you got to take care of your loved ones. So I would imagine they knew very well how Jesus was placed in there and all of that. So let's see, where am I? Verse 8. So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, greetings. And they came up, took hold of his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. So can you imagine just the excitement and just, it would be like exciting, confusement, is that a word? I just made it up. If it's not, write it down. So let's see, what's the, in Mark, jump back to Mark. There was like certain parts of each one of these that I just liked how they said it. Maybe it's let's go to Luke. So anyway, I don't know which gospel it's in, but it talks about when the girls came, all the disciples were around the table, or 11 of them were around the table, or this table, and they were talking. I would imagine this was like the disciples' funeral, so to speak. And they just had followed Jesus around for 3 or so years, and they had all these things, and they did many things. I'm going back to Mark. I'm sorry, I have notes everywhere, and then now I can't find where I put it. So the disciples are laying around the table, and they're talking. And if we remember back when Jesus was alive, they asked him a question, who is the greatest of... And now thinking back on that, you know, when Jesus talked about the temple, you know, dying or being destroyed and risen in 3 years, and they asked who's the greatest, I think they were trying to figure out who's going to be the leader of the group when Jesus was gone. And, you know, that personally makes sense to me. And what was Jesus' answer? He basically returned with a question, you know, who is the greatest? Is it the person sitting at the table, or is it the person that serves? But so there they are sitting around, and they come, and Mary comes with this news. And what do you think when the disciples were told this, and they're sitting around the table talking about, you know, what's next? What are we going to do next? How are we going to go about, like, are we going to keep talking about Jesus? You know, do we just go back to where we were and then they come in with this news that Jesus is alive? And I can see Peter saying something like, well, it's about time he rose, or it's about time he's alive, because they had this hope, right? And what is hope? You know, it's looking forward to something, right? Go ahead, what? Confident expectation. And recently I was watching this show, and it's about a sports team and stuff like that, and they're not very good, and sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not, but regardless, sports team, and some of the fans will say it's the hope that kills you. And the coach heard that, and he's like, the hope that kills you? He's like, what's that mean? And they're like, well, we just don't expect much from this team. It's kind of like if you're a Jets fan. You know, it's, you get Aaron Rodgers, you know, you finally get a great quarterback, and he played, what, 2 downs? Something like that. It wasn't long. And it's that hope that something great is going to happen, but then it doesn't. And it's very disappointing. And through life, we have, you know, the happy and sad things. And so I always say hope for the best but expect the worst. Because if you get your hopes up and as a kid, it's, you know, Dad, can you bring me for ice cream? And it's maybe, right? You never want to say yes immediately or whatever. We're going to get ice cream at some point because I love ice cream. You don't get this big not eating ice cream. So you have that hope and expectation. And if you're hoping for ice cream and it doesn't come, you get disappointed. If you're hoping for something and it doesn't come, it can be very disappointing. But if you're not expecting the ice cream and you get it, very happy, right? But the coach in this thing, in this show, and he was like, well, you should have hope because we're going to work together and do this. And there was parts of the team, he was trying to make the team become an actual team. There was like different sections and there was a click over here and a click over here and the team wasn't working together. If we've ever heard the phrase, well, you can't fit a square peg in a round hole, right? And has anyone ever heard that one? Square peg in a round hole? And in old carpentry, they would use pegs and things like that a lot. I had the pleasure of working on several old houses, and you know, nowadays everybody wants the open concept, right? So there's walls everywhere in this old house, and when they would build the post and beam structures, they would put these big beams together and they would cut them in such a way, and they would take a peg and they would slide it in, and that would basically be the nail. With a round peg and a round hole, there, even if you bang it in there, it still can move a little bit. And houses, you know, with being in New England, houses in wood, all the materials around here will kind of contract in the cold and expand in the heat. May be very minor, but they do that. They will, they'll swell and things like that. And when you put a wooden peg in a wooden hole, it has the potential to shrink and that peg move around. So old carpentry, if they wanted that to never move again, they would actually take a square peg and put it in the round hole. They would have to start the peg off somewhat round, but then they would take the peg and they would beat it into the hole, making that wood in that junction much stronger than if it was a round in a round. So when you take a square peg, wooden square peg, and you slam it into a round hole, you're going to do some damage. Like, it is not going to be a perfect circle anymore. There's going to be damage on all four corners. But that going in will now become a much stronger bond than the round. So if someone ever asks you, can you put a square peg in a round hole? You actually can. And it was something that the big time builders did and the very good carpenters did, but it wasn't a junction that wanted to be seen. As we go through life and we learn lessons, we get these scars, right? My daughter had the pleasure of learning not to touch a hot pan, and now she has a scar on her wrist. And My daughter's always asking me, Dad, tell us your stories of all your injuries. Because I'm like Tim Allen, with all the injuries. I get shot with a nail gun and cut with a knife and cut ligaments here and tendons and all these other things. And at every scar I have was a learning experience. So when you take this square peg and you jam it into that round hole, you have damage and it's not perfect, but it's strong. And I feel like the Lord does that with us over and over in life. And we take these hard lessons sometimes. But he makes tons of promises, right? And the Lord follows through with them. You know, God promises purpose in pain. James 1, 2, and 3, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. But then you have, he'll comfort you. 2 Corinthians 1, 4, and 5, who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God. For just as we share abundantly in the sufferings of Christ, so also our comfort abounds through Christ. You know, another promise, God will bless you. God plans prosper for you and not harm. God promises always to be near. God will give you peace. God heals. He'll protect you. God promises to work everything together for good. We know that verse, Romans 8:28. We all know that all things work together for good for those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. We have all these things over and over, but God will protect us and care for us. And so he comes to the disciples, and now in Matthew 28:16, this is titled The Great Commission. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the ends of the age." So, what's the real gospel? What's the official? Logan, you know this one? What's the real gospel? The Bible? That is the good news. Jesus was, he died, he was buried, and then he rose again, right? Logan and us, we studied that a lot, and it was in 1 Corinthians. It was in 1 Corinthians like 5:2 or something like that. But it talks about, he died, he buried, and rose again. The one true God, the one living God. And he comes back, and he wants us to go and make more disciples. So he says that in Matthew about going out and doing that. In Mark 16:14, we're starting in verse 15, "Go into all the world," this is Jesus talking, "go into all the world and proclaim the gospel to the whole creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will accompany those who believe in my name. They will cast out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up serpents with their hands. And if they drink any deadly poison, it will not hurt them. They will lay their hands on the sick, and they will recover." Right there, it's talking about the Lord is basically saying, "Hey, I am with you now. If you do these things in my name, great things will happen." I think in Matthew it talks about the mustard seed. You know, how much faith do you need to move a mountain? It's a little baby mustard seed. It doesn't take much. But he will do great things with you if you are with God and are doing what he asks of you. And what is exactly he asks of you? That's a tough question. Because at any time it can change, but what is it that he asks? And they think of the fruit of the Spirit and how to control ourselves. And the fruit of the Spirit's on the wall over there. And love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. You know, that's for us personally. And are we doing these things on a regular basis? We think of, and if you put yourself in the time of Jesus and the time that, you know, since when he came into that city and was just beaten on physically and emotionally that whole time, and the pain that he must have felt. And sometimes being a father and stuff like that, like if you see your kids go through pain, you want nothing else but to take that. And sometimes when I had surgery, I had ACL surgery, and I had to watch my wife, she felt pain for me, and it was painful for me to watch her feel the pain. As weird as that may sound, but we go through all these things, and it talks about Jesus being right there with us every step of the way. We think of the footsteps poem about how you only see the one set of footprints, and it was then he carried us. But when you're going through a struggle and you know, and you have that time to think, and you think that you're alone, and you're praying by yourself, and not even your best friends are staying awake to talk to you or help you out, and you're there alone. You know, think about what Jesus did for us. And if it was only one of us, he still would have done it for just you. He would have done it for just me. And I think that's what makes our God so great, that he has the hair on our head counted. I know most of us could count the hair on my head, but he knows us individually. If we have a specific problem, we can go to him, and he will answer that question. And if, I don't know if you've ever been praying and you're going through a problem, and then all of a sudden, you're like, wow, someone comes to you with something and it helps your problem. You're like, oh, wow, I can't believe that just happened. The Lord just works in mysterious ways, right? And there's been time and time again, I know, in my life where I'd be struggling. And I remember one time I was a general contractor for a long time and I didn't have any work. And it's kind of rare for me at that point to never have work. And I called a painting friend and I was like, I don't know what to do. I have nothing to do for the next 7 days, 8 days. And I was like, I have a couple of jobs, but nowadays if you have to order a window, it takes 8 weeks and whatever. So I was like, I have jobs in the future, but I have nothing coming up. And he's like, well, how long have you prayed about it? And I was like, I called around with some friends. I didn't pray about it. And there I did. I went and prayed about it. And it was like almost immediate. The Lord took care of it. I had something to do literally the next hour. I had to set up for the next day to work. So the Lord is right there with you. The one true living God. And what does he, and he comes back, appears to the disciples, and he asks us to do one thing. And it was go and spread the gospel. You know, that's basically our job now. Go and spread the gospel. Be a light in the world. And you, I know as a kid, too, we would go out and we would witness. We would go to, like, a park and things like that. And I'm not, like, I'm not what you would call an evangelist. I would struggle to just break out into conversation and try to get someone to go to church and or things like that. But you can be an example of Jesus without talking. You know, my dad likes to always say that little phrase, your work works and your talk talks and your walk talks, but your walk talks louder than your talk talks. Something like that. A lot of talks and walks in it. But we'll write it down later. And but your walk is the example. And if you mess up, you just get back into it. And in sports and also in life, they talk about, you know, it's not about falling down. I was just telling Pete and Tom before I had a baseball game yesterday, and there are certain things that, like, you dream about as a baseball player, and it's throwing someone out at home plate. It's like, it's the greatest thing in the world as a baseball player to actually be able to do that. And the game was down to the wire yesterday. It was 7-4, last inning, two outs, bases were loaded. The other team's best hitter got up, and he hits it to the center fielder, and the center fielder at first stood there, and we're like, all right, game's going to be over. This guy's fantastic. And then he turned around and started running backwards. He fell. The guys are running around the bases, and the pitcher, a good friend of mine, he's standing behind the home plate. He's like, oh, there's one. It's 5-7. The guy still hasn't gotten the ball yet, because he had fallen down. But he picked himself up, and he ran after the ball. He didn't just give up. He ran after the ball. So then the guy gets the ball and throws it in. Run. Next run comes through. So the pitcher's like, oh, no. It's 7-6. I get the ball, and I throw it in. And in my mind, is all I'm thinking is all those pictures of Bo Jackson when he goes and he throws that rifle and it goes thing. And I throw it in, and it just goes, doo, 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 starts bouncing to the catcher. And the catcher grabs it, tags him out, game over. But if that center fielder did not pick himself up and hustle after, we would have probably lost that game. And that's just an example of just picking yourself up and keep going. It's not about how getting knocked down. It's about what you do after. And when we're teaching someone carpentry and how to fix things and stuff like that, I tell them all the time, if you leave it, if you mess something up and you leave it, that's a mistake. Like, if you correct it, that's a learning experience. And every day we have different learning experiences, and each one of us is different, so it's going to be a different learning experience. But the Lord teaches us that, you know, he was mocked and knocked down and crucified for us, and then he got up and then gave us something to do. But he is right there with us every step we take, every day. We are not alone. And let's just close with that. Heavenly Father, we thank you and praise you for who you are. We thank you for being the one true God, for being with us, and for doing what you said by dying, because you were the only one that could have for us, the only sinless one. But you died, you were buried, and you rose again for us. So we thank you for sending your son. And please let us be an example for you through our life. In the name of Lord Jesus Christ, we pray.